Well, thanks very much, Ed. And it's kind of nice to be here in Oxford talking about this, because initially the inspiration for this study came from a project that was done in Oxford, looking at near misses just in Oxfordshire itself. So I sort of took that idea and did something related on a national level for cycling. So, yeah, it's quite nice. I'm going to start off just by saying something about the project. So this is a project that's looking at cyclists' experiences of near misses and related non-injury incidents. So stuff that is annoying or scary or, you know, could have led to an injury but actually didn't. And it seems to me that this is kind of a basically represents quite a large, potentially quite a large important thing in terms of people's cycling experience, but can also be something that might warn us about situations that might lead to injury. So I think it's important for two reasons. It's important for potentially for injury prevention, but also for thinking about how people experience cycling. So the study is about to start again for the second year, but it ran almost a year ago in 2014, and possibly a few people here participated. What we did was we had a one-day diary where people signed up to a day in advance on which they would keep a record of any cycle trips and any incidents that happened to them. So as I mentioned, we defined incidents fairly widely. We said, tell us about anything that made that, you know, frightened you or made you annoyed on your while you were cycling. We ended up with 1,532 UK diarists who recorded 3,994 incidents. So we got quite a nice data set of people across the country, particularly in England and Scotland, slightly lower representation from Wales and Northern Ireland, who were cycling on a specific day and who recorded any incidents that happened to them. Okay. So as I mentioned, I think this project is important for a few reasons. So firstly, some of these near-miss incidents might represent situations where there could have been an injury situation, there could have been an injury collision if things had been different. And one thing that occurred to me, having done research in this area, is that, for example, on the airlines or on the train in the train industry, if you have a near-miss, people learn from it. They think, well, you know, that could have led to a major disaster, that could have led to injuries, that could have led to deaths, and react to it in that way. But on the roads, for some reason, we don't seem to do that kind of thing. So one of the things that I was interested in is getting a bit of that logic towards thinking about the roads and thinking about how can we learn from what might be very widespread incidents that at the moment go unrecorded. Secondly, as I mentioned, cycling experience. So there's growing interest in near misses, and there's growing evidence that they can strongly affect cycling experience. Rebecca Sanders has done some really good work on this in the US, and she's found that near misses have a bigger impact on people's attitudes to cycling and people's worries about cycling than do injury collisions, because they're so much more widespread. So increasingly there's this quite interesting evidence coming out. And also I think it tells us about risk, and I'm really interested in risk. And if people know about the debates around attitudes to cycling, there's this big thing about, you know, the objective risk of being killed or injured is thankfully quite low, but people tend to feel that cycling is very scary. So what's in between that? And I think potentially near misses, potentially these kind of everyday incidents, are part of what comes in between those two things and can help us explain one of the reasons why people might think cycling is particularly risky or dangerous. So I wanted to go through a few headline results, as well as bring out a few things that I think are particularly interesting. If you want, there are some seats at the front. My lecturer's hat on. Because I'm still, because as you can imagine, with a data set with 1,500 people, 4,000 incidents, there's potentially an awful lot of ongoing analysis that can be done. So at the moment, I'm still doing some new analysis of the original 2014 data. So just this table, really, I think for me, is really quite an important one. And this is in the first published paper that came out of the year one of the study. So this gives you a sense of the magnitude of non-injury incidents, of near misses, compared to the risk of being injured or dying while cycling. So this is me doing a calculation of what an average UK commuting cyclist might expect to experience in a year. So it's quite good news that we can only expect to die once every 8,000 years. You know, that in a sense is good news. And even a reported serious injury once every 400 years of regular cycle commuting. Even any injury, reported or not, you know, however slight, is likely only to happen once every 20 years. So, you know, these injury figures, they're higher than they should be. They're a lot higher than they would be in the Netherlands. But they're still actually, you know, quite small in objective terms. But when you look at the kind of things that we're picking up in the Near Miss Project, actually, these kind of incidents that don't lead to injury, that don't get reported, are much more frequent. So, for example, when we looked at the data set, we coded for whether incidents seem to be deliberate or not. So that's the harassed or abused. That's where people think that a driver or someone else, in fact, deliberately threatened them, deliberately did something aggressive. And that's sort of 20 times a year for a regular UK commuting cyclist, which is quite common, a very scary incident. So we asked people to rate how annoying and how scary the incidents were on a scale of 0 to 3. There are a few seats at the front of you on, or there. So, and maybe the very scary incidents are the ones that we should be thinking about particularly, because when you think of, obviously some incidents are fairly minor, and I think it's probably unlikely that we'll ever get a transport system that never annoys anyone. That's probably, you know, that would be lovely, but that's probably not going to happen. But what I do think is realistic is the idea of a transport system that doesn't make people very scared on a weekly basis. I think that's more, that's more of a realistic goal. So people at the moment are experiencing very scary incidents on around a weekly basis. And any non-injury incident, that's about 450 a year. So some of those are very scary, some of those are not. But that's, in terms of the things that we, when we went through the data set, thought counted as a non-injury incident. There's full details of how those figures are derived in the journal article. So just to put it another way, around 6 in 7 of our participants experienced at least one incident on their diary day. So it was a normal experience to have at least one incident. One quite interesting thing was, in the qualitative comments that we got from people, people often said things like, I didn't realise that these were happening to me. I didn't think I'd record any incidents. But when I actually thought about it, I realised I do have these kind of things. So in a sense, you could possibly see that as bias. But on the other hand, you could see it as bringing stuff to light that people, you know, that it's happening below the surface. And potentially these kind of incidents could have quite a profound effect on newer cyclists in particular, and they might contribute to cycling churn. So a related paper that I've been working on has looked at people dropping out of cycling using the British Household Panel Survey, and it's quite interesting because of the people who say they cycle commute at any point in time, on the particular day of the BHPS survey, then only 2/3 of those will be saying the same thing a year later. So there's a lot of dropout, there's a lot of turnover among cyclists. So I think potentially near misses are one contributory factor. A quarter of the participants experienced a very scary incident, one or more very scary incidents, and half experienced a very annoying incident. So quite reasonably high levels of annoyingness and scariness in terms of these incidents. Most of them involved other road users. So mostly it wasn't like somebody almost cycling into a tree or something like that. Mostly there were other people involved. And 70% involved motor vehicles. So mostly they're involving other people, and mostly it's other people in motor vehicles. So as I said, we got a lot of qualitative data about these incidents, a lot of description, and we coded them inductively. So we went through and we looked for patterns in terms of the kind of incidents that people had. Now, my background is in qualitative sociology, and I know that there's often data sets where you really can't do that, and it's hard to draw, you know, it's hard to put things together like that. But in this data set, it was actually quite easy. There seemed to be some quite specific patterns. Just to give you a couple of examples in terms of the impacts of these incidents then. So again, a lot of qualitative data, a lot of description, a lot of people wanting to tell us about these incidents. So these are just some immediate impacts of, you know, how people feel just after something happens. My heart stopped, but this happens every time. This is a terrifying interchange for cyclists. I felt a bit sad that everyone is in such a rush as to cut others up and make the morning stressful. So the impact that has on how your day begins, you know, quite substantial potentially. My impatience was ever growing at just trying to get home and being fed up of cars blocking me. I also felt I'd made a mistake and was scared of being hit. So often quite a picture of a quite tense situation where people feel like they have to be cautious, they have to be on their guard the whole time. some longer-term impacts. In some cases, people said that a specific incident would lead them or could lead them to give up cycling. But more often, it's a cumulative impact. It's these things happening on a regular basis, I think. And that's what people expressed often when they're asked about, what are you going to do differently? There's often quite a resigned tone. I already approach this junction, and indeed every portion of the campus where I have to cycle on the road, with considerable caution. I can only attempt to cycle even more cautiously in future. So often a kind of a theme running through the comments, a feeling of sort of lack of control of, you know, what more can I do? An accumulation of these events over the years has made me super cautious, and I now believe it's not sufficient simply to obey the rules to stay alive. To stay alive, one must also anticipate that all others will be careless. And I think that sentence, when you think about that sentence, sort of the mindset implied by that sentence, it's kind of a bit chilling. The third one, at the moment I lack confidence, I feel nervous when vehicles come from behind. I'm fed up with drivers overtaking me towards oncoming traffic and providing me with insufficient room and or nearly pushing the other vehicle off the road. And I'll say something more a little bit later about some of the driver behaviour issues that were identified. But kind of quite a picture of the UK road environment as being not really a terribly happy place. And obviously this is people talking about incidents, and people often at the end we ask them for other comments about their journey, other comments about cycling, and that was where people said, you know, I love cycling, you know, I wish I didn't have these experiences, overall I keep cycling, I love cycling and it has many benefits. So this is obviously a negative picture, but I think it's one that we need to take seriously in order for cycling to be the wonderful experience it should be. So just to say something about what incidents are. So some of these incidents map quite closely to types of injury collision when you look at Stats 19 police injury data. Some of them don't. So some of these incidents potentially tell us about injury prevention and some of them don't. Some of them tell us more about cycling experience. So the big blue thing there with 38% is the cyclist's way being blocked. And I want to say something about that because people often think, oh, that's just something slightly annoying that, you know, doesn't actually have an impact. But quite often these were things like somebody has parked somewhere they shouldn't, so a cyclist has to pull out into motor traffic, that kind of situation. Or potentially, and quite common in London and some of the cities, a pedestrian steps out and, you know, potentially there's motor traffic coming around the other side, so the cyclist isn't quite sure, you know, has to stop very quickly. So it's not necessarily just, oh, that's a bit annoying, there's something in the road. It can be quite, you know, it varies, it's worth saying. The second one with 29% is, I've called it a problematic pass, but in virtually all cases, this was a driver, in virtually all cases it's a close pass. People who cycle probably familiar with what that means, they're overtaken very closely. The next one with 16% is a vehicle pulling out or in. So the cyclist is going straight ahead, perhaps a driver is pulling out of a side road, or perhaps a taxi is pulling out, a bus is pulling in. So these are pretty common in London, actually, these kind of incidents in particular, where you're having, yeah, basically pulling in or pulling out incidents. 6% is drive-at incidents, a vehicle... basically a person driving at a cyclist, and two kind of classic situations. The first one is a sort of narrow country lane where there's only space enough for just about one car. The car's coming one way, the cyclist's coming the other, the car keeps going and the driver expects the cyclist to basically pull into the verge or the hedge. So those were kind of rural types of this incident. The urban type tended to be that you've got a parked up road, which has become very narrow. The person's cycling along, the driver keeps going, doesn't, you know, and expects again the cyclist to kind of basically pull off the road and stop to let them get past. So that's a drive-at incident. Interestingly, that doesn't map that closely to a type of injury collision. Injury collisions are quite unlikely to be head-on collisions for people cycling to be injured. But these incidents were often experienced as quite scary when you've got a motor vehicle coming at you and obviously the person doesn't want to give way. The next one after that, with 5%, is a near left or right hook. So these are, you know, often in built-up urban areas, particularly in London, these are classic types of serious injury collision where you're at a junction and a motor vehicle turns left across your path, cyclist going straight on. So those kind of map fairly closely to types of injury collision. Other incident type at 3% was just things we couldn't categorise. Often it was just somebody shouting out the window or generally, you know, doing that kind of thing, throwing a can out the window. So often it was that kind of thing, but not, there was a few others that we couldn't categorise. 2% with tailgating and 1% near dooring, where, you know, the passenger often opens a car door, the cyclist has to swerve out the way. So these are the kind of incident types. And they do, as I was saying, some of them do map fairly closely to types of injury collision, but not all. Just to flag up one of the headline findings about incident rate, because I wanted to talk a bit more about incident scariness in a minute. But in terms of incident rate, I did a lot of cross tabulations. Then I built a regression model looking at predictors of incident rate per mile, incident rate per hour. And a lot of the cross tabs gave, you know, you could see that there were differences. And then when building the regression model, the interesting thing was it was cycling speed that made the major difference. That was the key predictor in the regression model, was the speed at which someone got from where they were going to their destination. So people, although we don't have the details of where people went, we have the timings of their trips and we have the distance that they think they've gone. So we have basically the speed of the cyclist. And in the regression model, basically what it meant was for a cyclist who got to their destination 1 mile an hour faster, the incident rate per mile went down by about 10%. There were quite substantial differences. And while we found a difference by gender, the reason for that was that women were cycling on average slower than men were. Obviously, there's a lot of diversity, but on average. So just to give you a little graph to illustrate that in another way. So this is grouping people by their speed. So on the left, you've got the people who are getting to their destination at 8 miles an hour or slower. And they're experiencing nearly 0.5 incidents per mile that they cycle. And on the right, you can see the people who are getting to their destination at 12 miles an hour or faster. And they're experiencing around 0.15 incidents per mile cycle. So it's a threefold difference. It's quite a substantial difference there. And there could be a range of reasons for that. That's something that people tend to pick up in the discussion. But I think it's very interesting. And one point is, for me, is whatever the reason for it, if you look at the profile of the speed that people cycle here, in the UK more broadly, compared to the speed that they might cycle at, say, in Copenhagen, you'll see a big difference. And in Copenhagen, say, there's a lot more of those people over to the left. So if we've got a cycling environment where those people over to the left are having many more incidents, then potentially we have a problem for diversifying cycling, which is something I feel very strongly about. This just gives you an example in terms of a specific type of incident, because obviously some incidents are more problematic than others, as I said. And one of the most problematic types of incident is a close pass. People, you know, often find close passes quite scary. And this gives you the rate by gender. And what's underlying that is the difference in speed. So you can see on the left, the rate per hour of close passes for men and women is pretty similar. I don't think it's significantly different. It's fairly similar. But you can see the rate per mile, women are experiencing around 50% more close passes per mile cycled. And underlying that, as I said, is the speed difference, which, you know, obviously there's a range of potential reasons for that. But then if you think somebody is going from home to work, 5 miles, say, they're experiencing 50% more close passes. Potentially that has an impact. And we know we have big differences in cycling rates by gender in a lot of the UK. On the right, the rate per trip stage is, again, not significantly different. Just to give you another graph, so in terms of incident rates across the day, so people generally, a lot of this cycling is commuting cycling, not at the weekend so much, but it's got a peaky pattern that you would expect for commuting. But this gives you incident rate per hour. And the interesting thing here, just to flag up, is that this is the morning peak. And actually in the morning peak, the incident rate goes up. So although there are more people cycling on the roads, there doesn't seem to be time-based safety in numbers effect in relation to near misses. So, you know, there may well be in relation to if you measured it in different ways, but in relation to, if you looked at safety numbers in different ways, but in relation to near misses, the near miss rate seems to be going up in that morning peak and to some extent in the evening peak, although perhaps less so. This is just another way of saying the same thing. This is me plotting the cycling volumes in terms of how many cyclists are liable to be on the roads against the near miss rate. And you can see there's a sort of weak positive impact. So when there are more cyclists on the road by time of day, the near miss rates tend to be slightly higher. Not massive gradient. The other thing I looked at more recently was looking at cycling levels in terms of the local area and incident rates. I thought, well, it would be interesting to look at the extent to which if someone's cycling in an area where there are more cyclists, are they experiencing lower incident rates? And this didn't seem to be the case either. So when I cross-tabulated the percentage of people cycle commuting in a local authority against the near miss rate for the people who are living in that local authority because we have their home location. If anything, there was a weak positive correlation, i.e. the people who were living in the areas that had higher levels of cycling tended to report somewhat higher near miss rates. Now, when I bunged this into a regression model, it wasn't significant. So I think there's other things going on there. For one thing, the places where cycling is higher or has increased, potentially the cycling demographic is different, potentially the makeup of cycling speed is different. So it's interesting, but there didn't seem to be perhaps the relationship that I might have expected. Just to give you a flavour of some of the current stuff that I'm doing, looking at locations, and then I'll talk a little bit about what determines how scary an incident is. So the location analysis, I've been splitting up incidents that took place in London with from incidents that took place in urban areas outside of London from rural incidents. And it's quite interesting because they have quite different characteristics. Although the incident rates generally across the UK are reasonably similar, the kind of incidents you get in a rural area versus metropolitan areas are quite different. And I think this is important for injury prevention and cycling experience. What kind of incidents are causing people problems in these different contexts? So to give you one example, the legend has disappeared. Okay. The thing I'll just highlight here, that purple bar is London. And what I'm just highlighting really is that when you're looking at A roads in London, a lot of incidents in London are taking place on A roads. So when I was talking to TfL about this yesterday, we were talking about the kind of places in London where incidents happen. For rural areas and metropolitan areas outside of London, A roads are less strongly represented. So there are interesting impacts, interesting implications here. I mean, obviously, people may be cycling on different kinds of category of road, but it gives you, like, this is a typical place where an incident might happen. Junction proximity. So the red bar is incidents not within 20 metres of a junction. So this is something you find in Stats 19 in injury data as well. This is a kind of classification. Is it happening near a junction? So this is rural areas. Rural areas outside... Oh, yeah. Well, they're outside of London anyway. This is rural areas. And you can see nearly all the incidents are taking place along links rather than at junctions. That's what you'd expect. That's what happens in terms of injury collisions too. For London, on the other hand, you're getting a picture where over half of all incidents are happening at or very near a junction. But for urban areas outside of London, that picture's not the same. So again, there are quite interesting implications for what, if you're looking at a particular type of area and if you're trying to improve cycling experience or perhaps use these incidents to prevent injuries, you know, there are potentially interesting implications. Just again to pull out one or two things here. So the red is rural areas. A lot of the incidents taking place in rural areas are close passes, whereas in metropolitan areas it's not so clear. In urban areas you're getting more incidents where people are pulling in or out. So, you know, again, perhaps not surprising, but there are implications for potentially what you do in terms of responding to these incidents. Involvement of other users, just to flag up perhaps, these different categories, HGVs, buses, vans, taxis, cars and so on, are just whether any of these groups were involved in an incident. They didn't necessarily cause it, but they were somehow involved in the incident. So what I would just flag up here is, this is the involvement of cars. So in rural areas, you're only getting around 25% of incidents are involving cars, which is interesting. In London, it's around 38%. In London, you're often getting a lot of involvement of buses, vans, HGVs and so on as well. The green one is urban non-London. So this is quite interesting. This is urban areas outside of London. And in more than half of them, private cars are involved. So if you're thinking about targeting road users, there are implications here, in different implications in different areas. And just finally, we also looked at the primary cause of incidents. So this was going through and trying to figure out who had actually precipitated the incident. You know, was it someone stepping out? Was it another cyclist pulling out without looking? Was it, you know, a car driver pulling out without looking? What kind of... So we attributed each incident as far as we could to having a primary cause. And again, the patterns were kind of quite different between rural areas, urban areas outside London and London. So again, just looking at the car, in London, it was only around a third of incidents were believed to be caused by a car driver or perhaps occasionally passenger. Whereas for urban and urban areas outside London and rural areas, it's around about half. So again, implications for perhaps dealing with other road users' behaviour. In London, relatively high rate for pedestrians in terms of precipitating incidents. So it's kind of quite interesting patterns there, I think. Okay, I wanted to say something about the impact of incidents then penultimate section, sorry, impacts of incidents. So as I was saying, you know, potentially some incidents are very serious and frightening, potentially other incidents aren't. So some incidents, you know, some incidents just are part of the, you know, rich fabric of cycling, you know, somebody, some child nearly runs into your path, it's all fine, but other incidents can be much more frightening. So I also looked at what determined how scary an incident was. So when we were looking at things that were associated with incidents being more frightening, motor vehicle involvement was a really key one. So this just shows you, the top one is how annoying and then how scary an incident was by whether a motor vehicle was involved or not. And this basically just is derived from averaging the annoyingness and scariness ratings. So people rated each on the scale of 0 to 3, where 0 is not at all annoying or scary and 3 is very scary, very annoying. So you can see that there's a bit of a difference in annoyingness by whether a motor vehicle is involved, but there's a much bigger difference in how scary an incident is. So for those incidents where no motor vehicle is involved, the average scariness rating is 0.78, so not very scary at all. For incidents involving a motor vehicle, the average scariness rating is 1.5, which is quite a bit higher. So that seems to make quite a big difference. Looking next, just at incidents where a pedestrian or cyclist is a primary cause. So these are where, yeah, a pedestrian steps out without looking often, or another cyclist does something silly. But what was interesting was that these incidents were significantly more scary where there were also motor vehicles involved. So in a sense, perhaps this isn't rocket science, but it's kind of for thinking about how we plan our streets and what kind of interactions are going to cause more stress for users. From a cyclist perspective, of course, this is only from the cyclist perspective. It's quite interesting. So where a cyclist or pedestrian causes an incident and there's no other motor vehicles involved, the average scariness is 0.68. But when there are motor vehicles involved, it's 1.0. So it does make a difference. And what was interesting was that people in the survey tended to give more leeway to other cyclists and pedestrians in terms of responding to incidents. They tended to be more tolerant of other cyclists and pedestrians doing stuff that maybe possibly put them at risk. So just to say something about summarising that, the incidents involving motor vehicles tended to be more scary. So nearly 20% of them versus around 1 in 20 being very scary. Incidents that didn't involve motor vehicles are pretty unlikely to be ranked as very scary. Incidents involving large vehicles were scarier still. So the involvement of HGVs, the involvement of buses and coaches tended to up the scariness rating. Not necessarily as causing the incident. You know, as I said, it might be a pedestrian steps out, it might be another cyclist gets in your way, but then you have to pull out and there's an HGV coming. That kind of situation tends to up the scariness rating. The types of incident mattered too. So incidents where people had their way blocked tended to be less scary than other incident types. Only about 1 in 20 of blocking incidents were very scary. So as I said, these kind of varied. Some of them were very scary, but many of them weren't. On the other hand, near-dooring incidents, incidents involving near left or right hooks, and incidents involving close passes were relatively likely to be judged as very scary. So around 1 in 4 of those incident types were judged very scary. So people are experiencing on a quite slightly alarmingly regular basis those kind of incidents, which are also associated with types of injury collision. You know, injury collisions, you will see doorings, you will see close passes, hit from behind type incidents, you will also see hooking incidents. So these are often quite scary, and they're happening on a reasonably regular basis. When I ran a regression model looking at incident scariness, those things were confirmed. So there wasn't a separate underlying factor I could find. It was about the type of vehicle and the involvement of motor vehicles, and it was about the type of incident. So for me, that sort of tells us stuff about what we should prioritise. So there's some things I think we should prioritise for reducing injuries. There's some things that we should prioritise for making cycling less scary. And there's other things that we should prioritise for making cycling less annoying, which I'd probably put third on that list. But, you know. Just to say something about the blocking incidents then, as I'd mentioned, people tended to give other cyclists and pedestrians more leeway, in a sense, or be more tolerant of their misbehaviour. So blocking incidents were relatively unlikely to be very scary, but they were quite likely to be very annoying. So, you know, this may not be threatening, but on the other hand, if you want people to use a transport mode, you probably don't want to make it too annoying. And obviously all transport modes are annoying to some extent, the tube or the bus or whatever, but, you know, you still want to look at how annoying it is if you're trying to promote it, I think. So the blocking incidents that were most likely to be judged very annoying were those involving being blocked by stopped or moving motor traffic. So, for example, as I think I said, you know, there's parking where there shouldn't be, car parking where there shouldn't be, van parking, whatever it is, and the cyclist has to swerve out. Those incidents were tended to be seen as particularly annoying. But on the other hand, being blocked by a pedestrian, this typically involved a pedestrian walking out in front of a cyclist as the person is cycling along. So potentially, you know, could lead to injury, but that was only judged very annoying in less than a third of cases, which I thought was quite interesting. Obviously, there were comments about pedestrians and other cyclists in the qualitative material, but, you know, the overall picture was that being blocked by parked cars or slow-moving motor traffic was more annoying. Being blocked by another cyclist was only judged very annoying in a quarter of cases. So, while people did express anger and annoyance with other non-motorised users, overall, their behaviour was judged less frightening and less annoying than those of drivers. I just wanted to finish, I guess, by saying something about driver behaviour issues. So one of the questions which may come up in 5 or 10 minutes when I finish is that we were asked was, you only get the cyclist's perspective, so isn't it rather biased? Because people obviously think that other people are to blame. And to some extent, one could answer that by saying, well, maybe, but it's still really important to get the cyclist's perspective because, you know, we want to make cycling safe and we want to make it enjoyable. But I then actually went and looked at how police attribute blame in terms of injury collisions. And this is from a report by Knowles et al., 2009, who did some detailed analysis of Stats 19 injury collision data. And this is how police officers are attributing blame for situations where a cyclist is slightly injured. So these will often be situations that are maybe not that different to my near-miss incidents, you know, but actually left someone slightly injured. And it's interesting that so on the left-hand side, you've got young people. Police officers generally think young people are to blame. However, where the cyclist is 25 or over, and most of my data set is people aged 25 or over, generally the picture is that for these three bars, these are the three age groups over 25, police officers are recording that overwhelmingly it is more the drivers. There are more driver situations where the drivers are contributing factors than where the cyclist is. So the overall picture is maybe not as dissimilar from the police perspective as you might think. Of course, there's also a question as to the extent to which the police are accurate, but, you know, that's a comparison that we have. Similarly, the behaviour changes that people wanted from drivers and from other road users more broadly kind of mapped onto the things that the police said drivers should be doing to prevent injuring others. Cyclists said, we asked people, would your incident have been prevented potentially by another person behaving differently or by the road environment or infrastructure being different? So people overwhelmingly said yes. People generally didn't think they had much power to prevent incidents, but they generally thought that most incidents were preventable. So in a sense, that's a positive thing. Maybe we can prevent a lot of these incidents. So in around 4 out of 5 incidents, cyclists said someone else could have prevented this by behaving differently. And this was higher, around 6 in 7, for very scary incidents. So the suggestions, again, to anyone who's read the Highway Code are probably not that unfamiliar. Waiting and patience, looking, being aware, checking. stopping when necessary, giving room when overtaking, and slowing down when necessary. But these are a lot of the things that the police flag up in Stats 19 reports as well, saying if the driver had done this, the injury might not have resulted. So I guess it's some support for that. But also, what we have that they don't have is detailed qualitative feedback on how cyclists feel about the behaviour of others, how cyclists feel about the road environment. And here I think we have a broader picture that's congruent with some work by Basford and colleagues from 2001 that I would really recommend everybody read. Really interesting report where they look at how drivers perceive cyclists' behaviour. And it's quite scary, actually, but it's really quite interesting because it paints a broader picture where drivers tend to have quite negative perceptions of cyclist behaviour, even when the cyclists are doing something that they're taught in terms of bikeability cycle training. You know, drivers often react negatively. And Basford et al. Say that cyclists are considered an out-group. And, you know, it's interesting to consider to what extent that is still the case. That was their research was done in 2001. But some of the things that people told me about incidents, you know, again, there's quite a worrying, you know, if this is sort of systematic behaviour. So, for example, these themes are just talking about, this is just one aspect of the data, but people are talking about looking and failed to see, which is a classic thing that the police record in Stats 19 data. So, first person says, the incident made me feel vulnerable and reminded me that a driver's failure to look causes a great risk. It left me frustrated because I wasn't sure the driver even noticed that he'd nearly caused a collision. And because of this, he won't have reason to change his behaviour in future. So it's feeling that people don't even notice when they're causing risk to cyclists. I was annoyed because the driver didn't indicate and didn't notice me as I had lights and an orange jacket on. Either that, or they did notice me and just expected me to get out of the way. It's a kind of theme, the extent to which there's some interesting research on visibility within psychology, where there's a lot of talk about how, you know, you may think it's obvious whether you'll see something or not, but actually it's determined by whether you expect to see it, what you're looking out for, what your, you know, what your views are on the situation. So potentially if drivers have negative attitudes towards cyclists, could this feed through into a lack of care on the roads? I feel like if I'd been a car, they would have paid more attention, taken more care. I overtook them in the traffic, and when they passed me again, I don't think they noticed me or cared about my safety at all. Annoying and unnerving. So just really, this is just a quote from one of the from the second paper, but another comment that I got was, well, if 80% of incidents are caused by driver misbehaviour or other road user misbehaviour, aren't the solutions education? And I wanted to say, I said in response, I think that culture, infrastructure and so on are all interrelated. And I think we need to look at this holistically. We need to look at the impact of infrastructure on behaviour and vice versa. Because I think, you know, the picture that we've got from the Nearmis project is quite alarming. I think there's things we need to do at a range of levels and make sure that what we're doing in one area isn't counteracting what we're doing in another. So I'll give one example. As I was cycling along, I don't know where the road is, but through Jericho to get here, I saw a coach in front of me with a sign on that, sorry, we in London are to blame for this, that said, cyclists stay back. And the message that that's saying is that cyclists should hang back, they shouldn't overtake, they shouldn't be getting ahead of motor vehicles. I think potentially that has that has quite worrying implications, because we do know that many drivers feel they shouldn't be overtaken by two-wheelers. Everybody knows who Ronnie Pickering is right now. No? Okay, Google Ronnie Pickering, it's quite funny. It's a video where he doesn't like being overtaken by a two-wheeler, not a cyclist, a moped rider. But I think we should think about how our promotional strategies, our infrastructure, our enforcement, our education, the kind of messages they send and the way that people behave. We need to take account of the way that drivers behave and cyclists behave. So, for example, one of the things that came up as problematic in the data set was traffic calming that had been badly thought through. So authorities put in traffic calming. The aim is to slow down the cars. They wait behind the cyclists. What actually happened, some of the people in the data set said, was that some of the drivers try and overtake right before the pinch point, and that causes then problems and distress and so on. So how do you design infrastructure that you don't have those unintended consequences? I think I've just said that. And also we need to research and monitor the impact of infrastructure and enforcement, educational changes and so on. So another example Mike, that I was actually thinking of the other day, is that in the US they've done some evaluation of messaging campaigns around Share the Road. And what they found in the US, in a context where also cyclists are not always seen as legitimate road users, cyclists interpreted share the road as meaning people should share with each other, and drivers and cyclists. Drivers interpreted it as that cyclist should get out of my way, why are they blocking me, why won't they share the road with me? So we need to think about these kind of things. I think I'll just move to the final thoughts now, because I want to leave. There's always questions and discussion. So I think near misses are important for cycling experience and cycling retention or uptake. I think there's a lot of stuff happening that hasn't really been studied and hasn't really been recorded until recently. Speed is the variable most strongly associated with incident rates per mile that people are experiencing. In terms of the scariness of incidents, if we want to prioritise the most scary incidents, these are the ones involving motor vehicles, particularly large motor vehicles, and they are often passing incidents, pulling out incidents, hooking, dooring incidents, the kind of things that we know may lead to injuries. So it kind of makes sense that people find them the most scary compared to some of the blocking incidents. And I think we also have in this data set a lot of qualitative insight into how these kind of incidents make cyclists feel, which I think is quite important for thinking about how people interact on the road and potentially the impact of interventions of various sorts. And it will be interesting to look further at some of these safety in numbers issues, because looking at this data, there didn't seem to be a safety in numbers effect for near misses in terms of time of day or in terms of the area that people lived in. Now, that may be that people are more aware of near misses in those kind of environments, or that may be that things that might otherwise be injury collisions are near misses. So I'm not, saying that's definitive, but it's kind of interesting and maybe not what I would have expected to find.